I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics Viral Tubing Mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know, the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS. .com/thrive for 20% off your first order.
Hi, I'm John O'Grant, one half of Joda with Darren Tate, and you're listening to Rebel Radio.
Fuck you, Josh.
What's up? This is Rebel Radio.
What up? What up? This is DJ Newmark.
This is Peanut Butter Wolf.
It's your boy. It's okay.
Keep checking out Rebel Radio.
Rebel Radio.
This is Rebel Radio.
We're in the place right here. Rebel Radio is going down.
Would you say Rebel Radio?
Oh, wait. Let's do it again.
Rebel Radio.
What's up, Rebels? Welcome back to Rebel Radio, the weekly show where I bring you the rebels who are shaping our culture. I'm your host, Josh Levine. This week, we're back on Zoom over to the UK interviewing Joda. If you're not familiar, Joda is a brand new duo of Jonathan Grant and Darren Tate. Jonathan is one third of the global trance superstars Above and Beyond. And he's also the co-founder of the Anjuna Beats and Anjuna Deep labels. Darren is a producer, composer under the name DT8 and many other aliases. He's also the founder of Mondo Records. And they came together during the COVID lockdown to create this Joda project and release their self-titled album out now on Anjuna Beats. The album is kind of blending 80s influences, especially, you know, some of the heavy synth modern rock bands of the time with sort of a modern trance electronic production. And it's a really interesting partnership. And we get into some details about their approach to creativity, how they give each other feedback, criticism, create room for experimentation, and generally kind of support each other while at the same time maybe pushing each other to bring their best to the table. We also talked something that I find really interesting about how the tools, in this case, analog synthesizers, really affected their creative output and their excitement even for the process. Something that at least I don't often think about is, you know, how the instruments, the tools of what you're making affects how you go about it. So it's good stuff. I hope you enjoy it. Let's get into the interview right now with Joda.
But I always like to start at the beginning and kind of how we got to this point. I'll ask you both. Do you remember the first record you ever bought for yourself?
I think the first record I actually bought myself may have been, but certainly on CD anyway, may have been Enigma Sadness CD single, and I went halves with my brother on it. It was nice. About £3.99, and we split the cost. And
sure,
I think that was the first one. But the first sort of record that I remember being significant was the album Petra Boys Please. That was the first one I had on cassette, and I just played it over and over again. My Walkman, flipped it over the other side, would play it again and again. Yeah.
Nice, good record.
Yeah, that's come And also Blue, I suppose New Order Blue Monday was another one I had. That one as well, as massive. Early on.
Yeah.
Nice. I think it was mine with the Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. It's the first thing I seem to remember. I mean, I don't know where it is now, but I did. It's like, but that was, you know, obviously it wasn't been around, but that was, that's at least what I can remember.
Nice.
That or maybe, I don't think I really put it. First record I ever played was a theme for something to do with Sesame Street, but I don't think that's one that I necessarily want to have on my.
Fair enough. Yeah, that's interesting though. And then what about, you know, what we consider sort of modern dance music? What were your introductions to? Do you remember your first rave or your kind of getting turned on to dance music for the first time?
I can remember exactly what got me into it, which for me, I wasn't actually into dance music for years. I actually kind of hated it. And my brother was the guy who was into dance music. And what happened was, I don't know how I got hold of it off him, but I got a copy of Paul Oakenfold's Goa Mix on cassette. And it was taped off the radio. You know, I don't know if you ever did that when you were a kid.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, just sort of recording stuff off the radio. And so he'd recorded the Goa Mix. It was Radio 1's essential mix, Paul Oakenfold off the radio. And I went on holiday to Australia. And that's when I really bonded with that mix from memory, was when I kind of, listened to that on holiday again and again and again. And it was mainly actually the first two tracks that I remember being amazing, which was a track by Lee Kwan, Point Zero, which was Matt Derry under a pseudonym. And the other track was Grace Skin on Skin, the Orange Mix, which was a Paul Oakenfold production. Nice. It was a remix of a U2 track that he then took the vocals off and did another version of. I think it was U2 Lemon. But yeah, that's a huge impact on me. And I was like, wow, this is really musical. This is interesting. Because I think I was just rebelling against, you know, the fact my brother was into dance music originally. I couldn't like the same thing as him. It was silly. Sure. Really. But so I was more into like pop music, rock music, jazz, all that kind of, you know, everything from like Steely Dan to Pet Shop Boys. So there was an electronic thing going on there as well. Mm-hmm. But it didn't really blossom until I heard that Paul Oakenfold mix, and I was like, wow, this is really cool. I like this. I want to make some stuff like this.
Yeah. I mean, I think so often it's about, you know, who introduces us to something or the setting, the context, how we discover these things. It could be the same record, right? But presented in a different way. And we just have a totally different reaction to it. What about you, Darren?
I had to kind of, wasn't that dissimilar in a way, but in that, I had a friend. It was when I was at university, was really into, he used to listen to Pete Tong's Essential Selection on Radio 1, and the thing then, and he was trying to get me, I had a studio set up at university, but I was doing rock bands and all kinds of stuff, and music theatre, and he would bring round tapes of Pete Tong and say, and then I started hearing tracks. I thought, you know what, I really like this because it's got the dance energy, but then it's got all this kind of musical sense of, you know, the kind of music I connected with emotionally, you know, I found uplifting, and so I got interested and started making those records. And but to be honest, I never really went out clubbing, and I remember actually Amanda Reardon, who was the first singer for me on the Angelic records, she said to me when I did It's My Turn, which was the first top 12 record I had in the charts here, she said, what I don't understand, Darren, you've made this record, you don't ever go out. You've never been clubbing, and yet you've made this big club record.
Sure.
And so, and then I got to see it actually play live at, it was Homeland, La Parade, one of the festivals that we did in the north of England. And anyway, it was incredible, you know, the whole crowd went mad. And then I realized that, you know, how well it, this kind of music connected with people. And so one thing led to another.
Yeah, I mean, that's so interesting to I mean, it seems to be one of the themes of this album, from reading your bios and some of the background, is just how people are going to listen to or enjoy your music then kind of affects the way that you make it. And, you know, as you say, sitting in a studio and, you know, it's very different than going and seeing it out at a club or seeing people, you know, react to the music.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you know, also after I heard that Goa mix, I think I was about 14 at the time, something like that. After I heard that, I was then sort of like, you know, when I got to 16, I sneaked into a few nightclubs and started to hear dance music in nightclubs. And that's when I really, really connected with it. Once I saw and heard it on a system, what was fascinating about it was the fact that you'd hear a sound in the studio, or not the studio, I mean, my bedroom studio, let's say, you'd hear a sound at home and you go, oh, that sounds nice. And then you'd hear it on a big system and you kind of think, God, wow, that sounds completely different on this big system. And it influenced the kind of sounds you would use in the records. And I found that sort of fascinating, that not disconnect, but the difference between those two things of how you'd mix something or what you choose to do, you know, once you understood how things worked in a big room. And still to this day, you know, there's a lot of thought that goes into that, I think, in records, in terms of where they're going to be played. There's a really good book called How Music Works by David Byrne.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that book.
Yeah, and that book sort of, you know, it's not about dance music, but it talks about this kind of stuff and you know, the way the nature of the music is, if you've read the book, you'll know, it is based on the room it's going to be played in. If it's stadium guitar, you have a nice little delay on the guitar, but you wouldn't have tons of reverb maybe because it'd be washed out. And so that kind of always fascinated me as well about dance music, because it does need, and during COVID, you know, which leads into Joda, I found myself a little bit disconnected from dance music and a little bit more reconnected with the music that got me into dance music and, you know, the early days in a way.
That's really interesting. We actually had the opposite experience being locked at home. We started listening to dance music again more, and my wife would dance around the house and just kind of have our own, you know, our own little experiences, and we reconnected that way. But yeah, I totally get. I mean, I think these, you know, certainly the pandemic has changed or reshaped how music's being made, how it's being consumed and enjoyed, and, you know, our connection to it. You guys talked about, you know, those early records that I think we all just played over and over and over. You'd wear out the tape, you know, and that's so different in some ways now, I think, when there's this onslaught of new music just constantly coming at us. You know, those first ones were the only ones we had, so we had to play them over and over. And now it's, I think, very different. It's funny also, you know, I was thinking it, in the 90s, I was managing gangster rappers here in LA, and same thing, you'd come out of the studio and you'd take the tape to whoever had the biggest sound system in their car in the parking lot, and we'd go listen to it there and hear what that sounds like, because that was sort of the intended listening environment, right? How you anticipated people really enjoying that music. So what about getting started kind of making music? Was there somebody for you guys that really helped you get started or shaped your approach early on as you go from, you know, kids and kind of amateurs to becoming professional musicians?
Well, I started learning piano when I was four. I mean, I think basically my great grandparents, I was very lucky to know they had a baby grand piano. And I thought I'd go over there and I'd hit the keys and they'd go, for God's sake, get him some lessons. I was having to listen to him attempt to do whatever he's attempting to. And so
nice.
That was the first thing. And then I went on and kept doing, you know, eventually I was still learning piano and other instruments and theory and what have you. And you know, I started hijacking my own piano lessons. Instead of practicing like I was supposed to, I'd start discussing compositional ideas I had Funny. When I was supposed to be practicing with my teacher, and because he was a composer, I'd quickly get him to do what he was supposed to be teaching me, and he'd say, oh, okay, let's look at that instead then. And then you know, but all through this, and I think this also applies to Jono, if I'm not mistaken, I was had a weird fetish for electronic instruments, especially. I remember being a kid at like 8 or 9 and going to the London Rock Shop in Camden, which at the time was one of those places you'd go to check out gear, and just wanting it all, you know, and going, God, there's so many buttons and it just looks great. And I just would like to have this. And so it became this kind of sense of, we kind of grew up with this evolution in technology, and kind of learned to appreciate it and love it. And so there was a passion and a hunger there while this compositional side was going on. And so that's what really led to me doing what I'm doing, I think.
That's cool. Yeah, for us in the States, it was Guitar Center, and you could just go in there and they'd let you just bang on the keyboards as long as you
I've been to Guitar Center. I banged on the keyboards there as well.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, I think for me, very similar to Darren, actually, when I was about 4, something like that, I was playing the piano. My gran actually taught me how to play the piano because she was a piano teacher part-time as well. I just developed my own passion, very similar to Darren, where I didn't really practice the things I was supposed to practice as much. And I kind of experimented. But luckily, the environment was such that, you know, my mum didn't really pressure me too much. She was, you know, a bit eye-rolly about, oh, aren't you going to learn that piece? But at the same time, I think she let me follow my heart with it and do what I want to do. And I think the Jean-Michel Jarre thing, I know you've interviewed Jean-Michel Jarre, haven't you?
Awesome.
Great guy. Awesome guy. What I think is great about him is he's still as enthusiastic, or at least I imagine he is, as when he started. And I had the pleasure of meeting up with him a few years ago and having dinner with him because we did a remix for him. But he inspired me. My parents had his, it was a vinyl of the Essentials Jean-Michel Jarre. So it was kind of the best of at that point in his career. And I remember miming on the sofa when I was a kid, like miming to this stuff, and like, you know, I saw things like his Docklands gig on TV and just was like, wow, this is incredible. And it was also a good bridge for me, that kind of music, to get into dance music, because it was sort of more musical dance music. It wasn't electronic music, it wasn't dance music, but it was very musical electronic music. And then as I grew up, I just found ways to sort of get my hands on various synthesizers and, you know, did whatever I needed to do, mowed the lawn, you know, just saved up money and just would end up occasionally buying a piece of equipment. I bought a really bad drum machine, this Yamaha RX-17. It was rubbish.
Which I also had. I also bought the same one.
Get the same one.
Exactly the same one.
we could have got all sorts of drum machines in that era.
It's funny. That wasn't the same one.
That's funny.
Yeah, I had one anyway, and then I managed to get a Juno 106. But the first synth I had was a Yamaha SY85, and that was like a digital synth that could do a bit of everything. Mm-hmm. And that enabled me to start writing music. And I think it was, you know, also being around people at school, I had a really good music teacher who, again, was just encouraging to sort of be creative, which was really important. I think it's important that kids get to run free with it a bit. And then every lunchtime in secondary school, when I was, you know, between the age of like 12 and 15 or so, I would spend a lot of time. There was a little studio set up. They just had like a sequencer, 2 synths and a little mixer. And I just started playing with that as well. And that was around the time that I got that Yamaha keyboard. And, you know, there was never any question that this is what I wanted to do once I got into it. I wasn't even thinking about it. It was just like something I was enthusiastic about. And then when I went to university, I got the opportunity through a friend of a friend who was working in the music industry to remix a track called Strike, You Sure Do, which is a big house, sort of 90s house hit. I did it on spec, which meant, you know, just if they didn't like the remix, the record label, they wouldn't have been released.
Sure.
But they liked it. And then it went on the radio on Kiss FM over here, which is like one of the main stations in London. And it got on the A-list and it started getting heavy rotation. So that was the first thing that I had sort of a degree of success with. And then I was at university studying commercial music, and which is like music business and production. Mm-hmm. And I found I got more from the business side than from the production, because you kind of, if you're really into that, you learn it anyway. So I figured out pretty quickly that I should learn some of the business side, because I was going to find my own way with the production anyway. And yeah. So that's what I kind of did. And then, you know, started the record label with Parvo and Gina Beats, that is, and started Above and Beyond about a year or two later with Tony. And then that was the three of us. And then DJed a lot and made a lot of music and sort of carried on doing that for 20 years, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. So let's go with that a little bit. You guys both run record labels that are very successful. And so I'm curious, how does being a label owner sort of change your approach to making music? And obviously in dance music, it's very, everyone kind of has their own labels, but a lot of times that's just their vehicle for releasing their own music. And you guys have gone well beyond that and have, you know, quote unquote, real labels. How's that changed the creative approach also being the label owner?
I think it's actually really challenging, because what everybody else gets that you as a label owner don't get so much is A&R. So people send us records. I'm sure it's the same for Darren, you know, send us records and ask for feedback on them. And as a label owner, I've kind of found myself in this position where I have to be my own A&R guy, or I have to have a handful of people who I trust for an honest opinion on something. They're not just going to say, yes, it's great, you know.
Sure.
Because you do need a little bit of that sometimes. I think there's advantages and disadvantages to having that level of freedom. You know, because some records would never have been made if there was an A&R guy saying, hey, that's rubbish, or
right.
Come out. So there's an advantage to that, and there's a disadvantage to that. And what it does do, I would say, is it informs personally how I try, at least, to treat artists, because I'm very aware that there isn't one way of doing things. And if you say to an artist, yeah, I don't like that, or, you know, not into this, that's, you know, it's not always helpful, because or you'd prefer, if you'd prefer something another way.
Yeah.
I try and, as an A&R guy, I try and present that as in, this is how I would do it, but, you know, you should follow your heart on it and do it your way. But these are my thoughts, because I've just seen so many situations where I've been on the other side of it, where A&R people have kind of got it wrong, and then record's gone on to be a roaring success.
Of course.
But it's a really tricky thing to balance. I don't know how you feel about it, Darren, you know, being an artist and A&R, there's two quite different skills, aren't they?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like people like putting your different caps on, they say, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's an interesting position we've been in with this project, because, you know, it's really not only did we obviously it was on Jono's label, so is there the fact that we are taking the helm in terms of the creative direction, but on top of it was a new direction.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're making decisions, you're really figuring out the entire direction of the project as you're going along. There's no specific rule book. There are procedures, but we had to have an idea in our heads what we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
and figure it out. And so, you know, it was very tricky to just say to someone, well, what do you think, or where do we go? You know, I think, in my experience, a lot of the A&R guys that have been the best ones will be the ones who have gumption, have had real, you know, they've not followed the easy way out. They've not gone, oh, this is a remix, and so it's already proved, tried and tested, and so it's easy, sure, just rehash it again. They've gone, I had one of my biggest records was a track called The Theme. Literally nearly every label rejected that record. And then apart from one guy at Sony had the gumption to actually say, you know, oh no, I think this has got something. And it just shows you how, well, not fickle, but just, you know, it's so subjective.
Yeah.
You know, one's opinion. So you can't just necessarily rely on the person's opinion. You have to make informed decisions. And I think you have to, you know, really believe in what you're doing. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, that's a key part of it all.
So think about that creative process, and I've read some of some other interviews with you guys talking about sort of feedback and creating this freedom to just create. and to kind of, you know, say if you like something or if you don't, or, you know, and I think those are such fundamental skills for all of us. And so what do I want? I want some tips. Teach me a little bit of, you know, how do you create this sort of safe space, but also honest, you know, direct feedback and kind of, you know, not getting each other's way too much.
I think what you just said, like, if we talk about it, like Darren, remember Darren saying, you know, this is going to sound crazy, but let's try this. Or, you know, just literally putting that out there on the table, that this is the way it's going to be between you as a partnership, is really important, just so that you know that's the way it is. And it's just important. I think if I look at my own biggest fear, if I go into the studio with someone else that I don't know, maybe it's that, oh, they're going to find me out. You know, it's the imposter syndrome thing. And and that I'm not going to come up with anything. And yet, you know, I've made all these other tracks, but in my head, I don't have a big ego about that. It's like, you're only as good as your last record in a way. And I think that you've got to leave that behind in some ways, and also create an environment where you feel comfortable. And I think one of the ways you do that is just simply by talking about it and just being open, you know, verbally, just making sure that you all know that you're open to experimentation, and that some things that happen in the room are going to be failures, and that's okay. And, you know, the idea that there's this kind of gusto about, yeah, we're going to get in the studio together and we're going to make a hit and we're going to do this, I suppose a little bit of that can carry you some way sometimes. And I think there is a time for sort of like having belief in what, you know, strong belief in what you're doing and then seeing it through. There is some value in that. But and there's an aside to that, I also think that's one of the most magical feelings in the studio, when there's two of you there, and it's much better when it's more than just you. You feel you've got something really great and you both know it. That's a wonderful feeling. But I think just being open to new stuff, not being dogmatic about certain things. No, it has to be this way, it has to be that way. And I think when both parties involved in a partnership have that and are sort of open to being wrong and open to failing, that's when you get the good stuff. And there's a time for sort of knuckling down and using all the stuff that you do know from experience when you're mixing the record and things like that. Well, there's also a time for experimentation there too. But it's a mindset that I think you develop between you as a partnership, and just remind each other of at times. And it's being open to change as well, because there's some times when we'd be in the studio and we'd both be quite attached to a particular part in a song. And it's a very common thing that happens, I think. And then, you know, in some of those tracks, we ended up throwing away that bit, and it was the right thing to do. It got us to a new place. And that was the right thing to do. So I think it's kind of an agreed approach you have between you, I think, more than anything.
Yeah, I love that answer. I mean, I think, you know, first of all, there's a lot of talk these days about imposter syndrome, and, you know, in the context of mental health and the pressures on successful or creative people. And I think the way you said it, you know, imposter syndrome is important, right? That feeling keeps us grounded in a lot of ways, and it may be uncomfortable, and that's okay too, right? But we need that. Without that, we're just, you know, rampant ego and without the checks and balances, and that's often what leads us to do our best work. I have a trick, you know, whenever I'm pitching or needing the freedom to create, right, is I always preface what I'm about to say with, let me just share a bad idea, right? Yeah. And so it immediately takes the pressure off me, because if it's a bad idea, I just, you know, I told you that already. And, you know, probably a good chunk of the time, someone goes, you know what, that's actually not a bad idea, because I've also taken the pressure off of them to sit there and be the judge. And that's sort of served me really well. And I think it's similar to what you guys are describing of, like, let's just try stuff.
Yeah, I completely agree with what you said. And Darren, actually, you know, the amount of times he said, Jono, this is going to sound crazy, but, you know, and which is a similar what you're saying there. And I love that about Darren and working with Darren, because that's really important. That's exactly the right way to be, I think, in the studio. And you're right, you know, about imposter syndrome. I think the tendency for artists or anybody who has that, once they want to get rid of it.
Right.
But it's not really about getting rid of it, is it? It's about managing it, if anything.
And, using it. And,
yeah, using it as well. And getting rid of some, it's part of you, and it's the, you know, it's part of your programming as well. So, you know, you've got to embrace it a little bit, some of the quirks we all have, right?
Mm-hmm.
I do think there's something to be said though for the there is one of the, I think, the key disciplines that you learn when you make music is like that, is knowing when to say, you know, I think it's the same way we talk about being able to, you know, sometimes it's good to take a break from something and, you know, get fresh ears, especially that mainly applies to engineering, I think, but just you get a perspective on things, you know, you're your brain, we get kind of, when we hear something in repeatedly over and over again, we get conditioned in a way. I'll get desensitized, I think is actually the right word. So, you know, then we've been there. And so even like Jono mentioned before, when we've quickly put together some of something for the initial ideas on this first album, we were very pleasantly surprised when we reopened the book on them sometime later and went, wow, you know, because they were like, we hadn't worked with them long enough to know them that well. And so, you know, and that just, you know, there's part of you that knows on a gut level, you'll know, and this is part of the discipline of working in the business long enough. You'll know something's not right. You'll know something needs cutting. But then there's still that part of the way in which we work where we do get, you know, be desensitized like that. And so can get fresh opinions. Things again, and I think that was part of the process as well.
I mean, I think that's so interesting, and it's something that, you know, I think about a lot is how do you know when a project is done, when a song's finished or the album or whatever, right?
It never is. Yeah. But
when the label is going, where the hell is this thing?
Of course, yeah. Yeah. And then if you're the label, right, that's all the harder because you don't have anybody else to blame. But no, I mean, I think that's part of that's, I think, one of the tougher parts of the creative process, right, is knowing when to stop. When you're desensitized to some of those things because you've just heard it for 36 hours straight.
There's a point where you can draw a line under something. Mm-hmm. I mean, even with the first album... after we sent it off, and yes, it's gone off to be pressed for vinyl, everything, and then one of us will go, oh, you know, I'm sure we can tweak this, you know. Yeah. And if there is an avenue to do it, then we'll take it. But at the same time, it wasn't like we got to a point with it where we thought it's not make or break if this thing doesn't happen. It's just embellishing and wanting to. But the two of us are not. We are not. I don't think we're certainly have some degree of perfectionism. There are limitations, and I think also, you know, you can't, you get to a point with something and maybe there's this you can do, maybe there's that, but I think you can get to a point where you're happy enough. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. And I think we did with that first album.
Yeah. I still, you know, for Above and Beyond tracks, there's still times when I'll end up loading an old track and changing the level of the vocal that bothered me 10 years ago, if it'll still load. Mm-hmm. So it never goes away. But I think also what Darren said, you know, there's a time in the studio to sort of be open to new ideas, and there's a time to kind of knuckle down and get the arrangement done or get, you know, move on and get something done. So, yeah. I mean... different times for different modes of being and
sure.
in as well.
Nice. So I know you guys had collaborated in the past, and I know you kind of got reunited through a film score, right? But I'm curious what drew you to want to collaborate again, you know, on this project. You know, what was that spark that you guys said to each other, let's go do this?
I think the first thing was that we were having a lot of fun doing the film score and stuff as well. And there was a natural window of time where we were waiting on the director to bring back the final cut. So we had some kind of spare time where we couldn't work more on the film because it would have been wasted time. And And COVID started to happen around this time as well, but it was before, it was just before that. And I said to Darren, come to the studio and let's you know, check out my studio, because I've been working in his studio because he's very much set up for all the you know, film score stuff with all the strings and stuff. And so Darren came down to my studio, and I happened to have a lot of old analog synthesizers which weren't getting turned on as much as I would have liked, and Darren started turning them on, and we had a lot of fun. I mean, I sound
very rude, don't I? Like Darren.
No, that was good. Darren just
went, no, Darren, you sound, just himself, you sound curious.
Himself, he just we went into the fridge.
Yeah, it was one of those things. It's not that I didn't use them ever. It's just that he turned maybe more of them on than I had. So then we started playing around with those, and then we made a track called Shape of Your Heart, which is on the album. And we didn't know what we were doing, what we were making. We were just having fun doing it, which is great. It was that back, that sort of curiosity, childlike, kind of playful thing that be what creativity should be about. But I think what happens invariably in the music business is the business can get in the way, and then, you know, the record label needs the next single or something. There's external things that come in, and this was a thing that happened where there was no external kind of tail wagging the dog or whatever. You know, it was just pure like joy and the fun of making music without any editor. So then we'd made that first track, and then we did a couple more, and then I just said, why don't we knock out an album of this stuff? You know, it'd be fun to do. Just and Darren was like, yeah, all right, why not? And then we came up with the album really over the coming months.
It was a very organic process, I think, because why that we have this track called We Find Ourselves, which, whether the title came about subconsciously or not, I think there was some, it's a very key idea, because it was a journey of discovery, not just into doing something different, but in terms of looking back on things that we had grown up with and loved. And, you know, we had a passion for all kinds of music, yet in some ways have been respectively, you almost get boxed in sometimes, you know, especially probably harder for Jono in a way, because he's got such a successful performing act that is a mechanism. So, you know, and then there is an expectation to do things in a certain way. So doing something, it's about having brought up and being, you know, he's a capable musician that's learned all the different things and had been passionate about music and all the different genres. And he's, you know, and then not had all this and had all these influences and heard all this music and grown up with this music. To actually sit down and start going, well, what would I like to do for a change in a way?
Yeah.
You know, sure. What would I like to go back and try doing that? Would I like to go down? Would I like to try? And the same apply, and the same also for, you know, Jono's singing on. I know he did do a couple of tracks of Bomb Beyond, but he's, you know, he started singing on the tracks, and there was a great symbiosis between his voice and the music we were doing stylistically. And then that kind of came about organically, that him and, you know, and so. And I think that's part of why the relationship's working so well, is because no one is making anyone feel bad. It's all like, oh, I love that, or let's try that, or let's have a go at that, and nothing's too stupid, and it's just created this very, and it's quite exciting, because, you know, you can see how now it's like a flower that's blossoming into something. It's getting a shape, and you're seeing all the colors, and you can see how it can develop, and it gives us the flexibility creatively to do things that we might not have otherwise have done.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's huge. So what are you talking about, kind of some of these old records that inspired, you know, this idea for this project? What were some of those records?
Well, I suppose, you know, a lot of it growing up for me, I suppose I haven't mentioned Phil Collins, but Phil Collins is a huge influence for me. So I suppose there are two areas of music that I, maybe two or three, but areas of music that I can identify with in terms of my main influences. And it would be music that my parents liked, but also music I was growing up with. And some mm-hmm. they liked that too, but they had a lot of, you know, old records. And like I say, the Jean-Michel Jarre thing, that was, I don't think I would have discovered that as quickly if my dad didn't have that on vinyl.
Sure.
So there was that kind of stuff. But then a friend of mine, Richard, actually, who was a friend of my sister, he had a lot of New Order albums as well. And I heard a lot of their material and Pet Shop Boys. And then a boyfriend of my sister had loads of Depeche Mode records. So I heard a lot of those growing up. And I always loved the synth sounds and the songwriting. So I think that that kind of music really was the biggest influence. And then there was a band called Electronic, who mm-hmm. there was a spin-off of New Order. And it was Johnny Marr, wasn't it? And Bernie from New Order, who created a side project. And that was a big sort of musical influence in my head as well. So that, and also dance music. You know, I think the music on the Joda album straddles that space between the sort of, like, you know, 90s dance stuff and a bit of 80s and also some later stuff. And we really wanted the production to be modern and in a weird way. It's sort of, it's influenced by that retro stuff, but at the same time, there's no point in doing that again. You know, right. It needs to have its own thing. So it's drawing for some of those influences, but it also is in a modern package in a way.
Sure. Yeah. What about you, Darren? Any other records?
I would say very similar to Jono. You know, the Duran Duran's, Depeche Mode. I like Level 42. Mm. I've been in terms of being influenced, because I've done a lot of film music. So I like a lot of the film composers. I grew up studying composers, the classical mm-hmm. composers. I especially like the more modern ones, the James Newton Howards and, you know, the Danny Elfmans and John Williamses and all them. So I, you know, passionate for that side of the music. And bringing in elements, but there is there's definitely that whole that scene, especially I suppose the 80s was particularly connected with me, and that's when I started messing with synthesizers and following down and getting drum machines, and that was the music that was around at the time, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we've got influences on our album from the 90s. People have brought up Underworld, they've brought Kavinsky, they've brought up, you know, Radiohead, you know, there's things that are I've just got a mental dot, but I mean there are these you know, the things that we've covered, the things we've grown up with through each decade, and got older with, and so I think we were quite willing to just try putting. It wasn't like it did belong to one decade. It was like mm-hmm. we like this from the late 90s. We have this playlist called Joda Selects, and I mm-hmm. think it kind of says it all in a way, because if you listen to it, it's very diverse, but it's music and songwriting that really connects with us.
That's cool.
I think you can kind of see a window into our brains if you look at that.
Yeah, I'll post that in the show notes so people can check it out.
That would be great. Thank you.
Yeah. So you had talked earlier about working on more music. So if, you know, this first album came out sort of or came to be in the middle of the pandemic, and as you said, you know, there's no touring and you know, felt like a time to create a different type of project. What is the next one? You know, now we're in a different, the world's in a different place now. So what does that do to your perspective on the next project?
I think the question that I've got is how we create, obviously the next album will be different. Every album should be different from the last one, but how do we create in principle the same vibe where, you know, we had a lot of space, and that's the key point. We had a lot of time and space to kind of work on it, and, you know, let's say a lack of interference from external things, and sure. I think that's the key challenge as I see it, is how do we recreate that again. I'd love to have like a studio somewhere in the countryside we could go for 2 weeks, even if it's more bite-sized sessions. It would be be good to do stuff like that, I think, to sort of recreate a bit of the best of the pandemic. That's such a term. But what do you think, Darren?
Well, I think that while there is, we're a bit more stressed in terms of the amount of time we have at our disposal, because obviously certain projects are up and running again. There is, on the other hand, we have a better idea of what we're doing. So from, I think, sonically and engineering point of view, and so we've already got a lot of ideas at certain degrees. Whether John is even aware of it, I sit there occasionally knocking out more bits, which we will eventually sit down together and work through. I do think I think the response online to this project has been overwhelmingly positive. People have embraced it in a great way, but more, and that includes, you know, the dance fanatics as well. Have embraced it, which was the trick to me, was winning them over. And there are a lot of people, and I see it all the time, going, we'd love to see you live. And, you know, you can really see it, the enthusiasm is there, which is such a motivational thing. So I think, as Jono has said, you know, we enjoy working together. I think it's almost therapeutic. And I think it's important to, you know, I was doing a thing for a television program in America this week, but it's now I enjoyed doing that for a few days. Now today I worked on something for Joda, and that's great. It's just great for creatively to be able to do different things. And so, and, you know, I think the intention is going to be there to continue on with that in mind. It's just striking a balance and finding the time to do these things.
Yeah. Like Darren, we've got, there's quite a few tracks we've written already. Plus Darren's done some bits, as you said, we've probably got enough for most of an album, but we want to approach it like we did the last album. We reached a point where we had maybe 15 tracks or something, and we cut it down and saved some for the next one sort of mentality, because it just felt better to do it that way. I really want this project to be, you know, a situation where we're not sort of like trying to fill space with stuff or something.
Of course.
It's really important to, let's write 20 songs and let's pick the 10 we love, or, you know, that sort of thing. It's really important to me that that's the way this works. And we whittle it down to the best, or the most suitable, the best. Sorry. Well, my album together.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think neither of us would be satisfied with the, you know, we both care about it too much to want to, you know, cut corners. Basically, you know, we want to make sure that everything is a moment with something like this, you know, and it's also, it's not just some of the decision making with these records is, it might be you love a record, but you don't find the space of it in an album because the album takes you on a journey. It just might be there's no room for that extra left turn or whatever, you know, because the album itself is a work. In its flow from beginning to end. You know, it doesn't even mean there are tracks we might love, but they just may not fit on something that we're that do. So there's that creative side of it as well.
Sure.
Yeah, it was nice.
Yeah, I'm glad you say that. I mean, I should have said this at the beginning, but I really like the record. I've been enjoying it. And in particular, you know, kind of what you just said, I like the journey, and especially, you know, as somebody who's, you know, streaming an endless supply of dance tracks, where you're sort of left to create your own journey, or the algorithm maybe tries to do that for you. I think, you know, it's a welcome kind of return to an album concept that, you know, that takes you somewhere.
I mean, it was really important. That was also really important to, we wanted to make an album we were happy with and sort of not worry about the algorithm, you know. Maybe if we'd have been, you know, more intelligent about, you know, certain lengths of certain things or orders and things like that. But we specifically kind of, you know, made life harder for ourselves in some ways in the aim of, you know, making something that we hope people will listen to in a few years' time.
Sure.
Not just sort of tomorrow or yesterday. So that was
great.
Important. And like Darren said, there's at least one track I can think of that we probably would have put on the album, but we had what we needed, and it just felt like we're not going to shoehorn in another track and make it even longer, or you know, just didn't need it. So so it's nice to be in a position where that can be there, and we can actually relax about it and go, well, that's there, that's great, and we'll put it on the next one. So
so you talked a little bit about how your past experience kind of informed this project. What about going forward? How do you think this experience working together, how do you expect that to impact your future projects, on, you know, the stuff you're doing separately?
You want to go first?
Oh, I mean, I'm, you know, I do lots of different types of work. I think that, I mean, I was tinkling around this idea of all the old school gear and switching that on was something I was playing, started really getting into just before we started the album. And I think what Jono and I have become very, very much of that way of thinking, with some obsessive synth buying that has happened as of late. In fact, Jono is now sitting behind, I don't even know why I've got it back there. So I think there is that side of it, a reappreciation of those tools we've had lying around. I know John has been using, even in some of the remixes he's been doing and new mixes, been switching on the gear. I think it's that's definitely one thing from a creative approach. And so we'll keep that, something that is going to be on our heads moving forwards, in to answer the question. As is, but I think the other thing to say is that, and I think we both strongly agree on this, and one of the things we do, and whether it drives each other mad or not, I don't know, but we often share tidbits of things that we come across our play, whether it's a producer talking about something or a new plugin or whatever else. And that's part of the relationship of being open and being able to discuss things. But it also is important because it shows that your willingness to keep learning, because the world is changing and technology is changing, and you have to embrace that. You know, we live in, you know, and especially as it becomes easier for people to access, you know, back in the day, you'd have to have quite a lot of money to go and record an album and have the kind of equipment that people now have on their laptop available to them. So there is more onus on taking the time to learn and keep up with the technology and to be open-minded. That doesn't mean to say there's great, you still need the skill set and the appreciation of what's come before, but you've got to be willing to still learn things, and that makes you a better musician, it makes you a better composer, makes you a better engineer. You know, so I think that's, I hope I answered the question there, but I think it's just that constant need to learn is the thing we take forward as well.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Darren, whenever I work with Darren, one thing I will say is that Darren always wants to innovate, and you know, it's very important to Darren. And yeah, I always take, whenever I'm working with Darren, I always take that away of like pushing that bit further. But yeah, using the hardware, I mean, yeah, like I said, I've just, there's one here. It's just my wife's not, as you can imagine, my wife's not particularly happy about that bit. She asked me when it's gonna get in the studio. I need a MIDI kit.
That's great.
Hang on. I've got this one in here. This one I've got that because Jono was like, oh look, go on eBay, the synthesizer's gonna be sold in an hour, in like 5 minutes. I didn't even think about it. I went, all right. I mean, we're basically insane. Oh, that's the bottom line.
so I think the idea that, the innovation thing, but also, using the hardware, like Darren said, I just did some work on a remix, an Above and Beyond remix of We Find Ourselves, a Joda track that we played at AGT 500 in LA last weekend. And, you know, I was using some of the hardware on that, and I don't think I would have, I did, you know, use hardware on records, but I used a bit more than usual, let's say. So that was probably a little bit of the influence of the pandemic, Darren, you know, just sort of falling back in love with the instruments, because I suppose with all the vintage synths and, you know, real instruments, if you like, rather than using your mouse, there's nothing wrong with that on the computer. But there is an interaction you get, even if the sound isn't better, there's an experience you have and you end up doing things you wouldn't normally do with the software. And that, it's the other way is true as well. You know, there's things you'll do with the software that you wouldn't do with the hardware, and they're both absolutely useful and valid. But I guess I wasn't embracing the equipment. I kind of turned most of that off and was focused on using the software a bit too much, and it's just redressed the balance. So that's been really, really, really nice. And I think if you think about it, there is a lot of nostalgia in things that we do as adults. And for me, you know, growing up, I always wanted to play with all those synthesizers, but I couldn't afford them. And now I've got them. Sure. And, you know, to not use them.
Now you don't play with them.
Yeah. I mean, so it's been great. Yeah. Reigniting that passion.
That's great.
And it's great that, you know, Joda has been much part of that, because the whole project has been based around all these synths, but bringing them into modern era. And that's, that's the sweet spot for me. Doing those things.
It's quite interesting as well, because it's, as John has said, it's like with these synths, it's, they have their quirks and whatever, but they're very much hands-on. You know, you have a controller, you know, you've kind of got everyone, you can access a lot of what you need in front of you. But on the other hand, there is that, you know, by having it in a computer and doing the same thing with the mouse, you can very easily undo what you've done. You don't have to print recordings through analog outputs of a synthesizer. You don't commit things. So they're two completely different ways, approaches. And so while the mouse, on the one hand, can make things quicker in terms of I can pull up the synth, I can do that. On the other hand, you might end up spending longer trying to get that soft synth to sound like, or to get the mojo you would have got out of the hardware device. So they're kind of, you know, it's not as straightforward as thinking one thing might be quicker than another.
And what was nice, actually, working on that album was that we recorded in bits by hand, you know, on the keyboards. Normally, you'd, even if you're using the hardware, a lot of people, what we would do a lot of in the past was use MIDI to record the parts, quantize them and everything, then record them in. But there's actually quite a few parts that are a bit out of time and just played in by hand on the album. It just gives it give it a bit more of a human touch. And, you know, I think there's a rawness, even though we're naturally drawn, both of us, to sort of perfection at the same time. I think we both recognize that we need to keep a vibe there, and it's not everything is perfect on the album, and we're kind of happy with it that way. It was more when we got to the mixing that we got a bit perfectionist and trying to iron out kinks, but you never get it perfect. It's what is perfect as well. And all the music that I like tends to be stuff that has a bit of a vibe to it and isn't per se, you know.
Yeah,
that's great. And I think for, as a listener, you know, that's stuff that we can't hear, but we can feel.
Yeah.
And it ends up really important in the experience of the music.
Completely. I completely agree. I did a project. I was asked to redo Al Green, the soul artist. I redid a lot of his big records with a label in America. And you know, it was, as soon as you try to, if you start putting those drums in time or whatever, it just sounds ridiculous. It's like there's no mojo.
Absolutely.
You know, you're taking the nuance of the player out, the play, the subtleties and the nuance. There is a degree of too far wrong.
Sure.
There's no question about that. But there is a fine line with mojo in these things. And I think, you know, and that's something that sometimes having that little bit of movement and spark and natural and humanity in the musicianship and the performance does, you know, it's irreplaceable.
Yeah.
You know,
I love that.
Great players on Al Green as well, you know.
For sure.
Oh yeah, amazing musicians.
Well, I know it's getting quite late out there for you guys, so I have a quick lightning round before I let you go.
Okay.
If you don't mind. So you can both answer, you can take turns, whatever you want to do. I'll leave it up to you. What's your favorite city to travel to?
Well, I'll say one of the most recent ones I went to, which was Edinburgh, because I love going there, because it's really picturesque. But in terms of a great show, I'd have to go for Los Angeles, because we have amazing shows.
Yeah. Nice. I love LA as well, to be honest, as well.
Nice. Me too. Although I love to get over your guys' way as well. Well, you're definitely not going to like this next question. Who's your favorite DJ?
God, I mean, well, one that did change my life years ago was one from Paul Oakenfold in the late 90s, or it was around about 2000, just because I saw the way the audience interacted with the music and the lights. And
that was a magical time. You know, I think so many people were discovering dance music around the world for the first time around then with Paul and a few of those guys.
Yeah.
What's the last great book you've read?
I would say it was that How Music Works.
Yeah, I love that book.
David Byrne, great book. I recommend any musicians to read that. And the reason being, because I feel like I spent a lot of my life thinking in music, thinking, oh, you know, why are we doing this? Why are we doing that? In terms of certain decisions with the music making. And that almost helped me back off on that and be more relaxed about it and go, oh, it's okay for the fact that I want to mix the record like that. Or, you know, that's because it kind of works better in that environment, or, you know, just certain decisions that you make. You understand, there are limitations in the creative world that are set by where the music will be played, and that's okay, you know?
Sure. No, I love that. And for me, you know, it was a great reminder. We have this, you know, this ongoing cultural debate about of the idea of good music versus bad music, right? And for me, that book really put all that into context, and, you know, this and that it changes, right, with how it's being consumed and the place and the time that we live in. That affects what's good and bad, and you know, kind of how we receive it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. I know it opens a lot of questions and answers a lot of them as well.
Yeah.
The last book I read was Fire and Fury. I wouldn't say it was great, but it was quite a lot of fun.
All right. Nothing wrong with that. What movie do you think you've seen the most in your life? Maybe not when you're scoring, because I don't know if that counts.
I think for me, that would be Back to the Future, probably. Mm.
Nice.
Godfather for me. Godfather. I've seen Godfather more times than any other movie. That and this for sequel, because I tend to watch them together.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if you saw The Offer. But wasn't that great?
Yeah, kind of Miles Teller.
With Miles Teller, talking about how The Godfather got made, and what an amazing story.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it. I thought the reviews weren't that good, but I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really, I enjoyed it. I'm fascinated by it. And it was just interesting how they just showed the madness with the mob and everything that was going on to try and get it made. I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, we watched that, and then we went back and watched The Godfather again with that fresh in mind.
This is why I've seen The Godfather too often. Somebody brings up the book. Oh, you know when that, you know, it's one of those things.
That's so cool.
It's brought up a lot.
Nice. Who's somebody you haven't met who you've learned a lot from?
I'd say John Williams, but in terms of from a writing point of view. Because I have never met him, but in terms of musicianship and approaches to scoring, I would say he's definitely one of my biggest influences.
Sure.
In a weird way, I'd say Madonna, purely because, like, when I think of Madonna, I'm not a massive fan of the music these days, being perfectly honest, but just in terms of a pop artist who constantly reinvents herself and just the way that has been managed over the years is quite incredible, and I think it's something that, you know, any artist can learn from.
100%. I think, you know, what she's done is truly incredible, and I think that first record is pretty amazing. If you go back to it, it sort of stands the test of time.
Yeah.
Last question. If I worked for you, somehow I was on the Joda team, what's something I would hear you say over and over?
Darren, you know what that is, I'm sure. I'm sure you've got it written down.
Something that you'd say over and over. Something like, why do we keep doing this? That would be something that I probably heard at 11 o'clock most nights.
All right.
After we changed the record completely, and then it was like, oh, why is it not right now? Within half an hour of doing it.
To ourselves. you might hear. So the fine line between sort of self-punishment and
that's great. Well, thank you both so much. I really enjoyed talking with you. Like I said, I love the record and I'm excited to see what you come up with next, and hopefully there'll be a live show in the future that we can all enjoy. So I'll definitely share all this in the show notes, and we'll be watching for what comes next.
Brilliant. Yeah,
thanks for having us on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. Thanks for taking the time.
That was Joda on Rebel Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. Make sure you check out the Joda album on Spotify, Apple, wherever you listen to music. I don't really care where you listen to it, but check it out. And leave us a comment. Let us know what you thought. Hit us up on Twitter, Facebook. If you're into video, you can watch all of our episodes pretty much now on our YouTube channel. And most importantly, come back next week for more Rebel Radio. Peace.